Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Remember, this is our capital. This is our house. We're not moving until we get our way.
A Texas militia member was the first to go to trial in the January 6th insurrection. Prosecutors said that Guy Reffitt, quote, lit the fire of the very first group of rioters that breached the Capitol. And they not only had photos of him storming the Capitol, they had video from his own helmet camera.
Taking the Capitol after this.
I didn't come here to play games. I'm taking the Capitol. I just want to see Pelosi's head hit everything. Stare on the way out.
Reffitt had the sad distinction of being turned in by his own teenage son. Jackson Reffitt told CNN his father had threatened him and his sister as it became clear that law enforcement was hunting down rioters.
He said, choose a side or die. And if I chose a certain side, I would cross a line and he would do something he didn't want to do.
The jury took less than 4 hours to convict Reffitt of all charges, including obstruction of Congress, a crucial victory for the Justice Department. Joining me is Eric Larson, a Bloomberg legal reporter who covered the trial. Eric, tell us what the charges against Reffitt were.
So Mr. Reffitt was accused of basically leading the first crowd of rioters that went up the steps of the terrace and eventually broke into the Capitol. So they claim that he really led them on, egged them on, encouraged them to more forcefully confront the police, which they did. They also claim that he was armed with a pistol, a loaded gun at the time, and that he had traveled to Washington from Texas with an AR-15 as well, which he had left in his hotel room. So they claim that he went there prepared for battle and prepared to fight, and that that is what he did.
Was there a reason why he was tried first of all the January 6th rioters?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, more than 750 people have been charged. Only around 200 or so pleaded guilty. So there are hundreds of people who are supposedly going to go to trial here. It just seems that this one sort of moves the fastest. We're going to see a lot of trials later this year. I think it was just the luck of the draw for him.
Let's talk about the prosecution's case. And what was so unusual and telling was that his son was the government's star witness against him.
Yeah, that's correct. That was a real twist. His then 18-year-old son contacted the FBI, informed them about his father's involvement in the riots, and even went so far as to secretly record his father talking at the kitchen table. He put his iPhone down on the table and just let his father speak as he was bragging about all of his activities on January 6th. So he really went pretty far in trying to help the government. And one of his reasons for doing so is that at one point, as his father realized that so many rioters were being arrested and charged, he threatened his children to keep them quiet, knowing that they had different political views than he did and knowing that they had some pretty incriminating information. He told them that speaking with law enforcement would be treason and that traitors get shot, as they put it.
And some Capitol Police officers testified. Did one break down on the stand?
there were several who testified, and one in particular, she was in the command center during the riot. And, you know, they have several different commanders and officers in this room with lots of screens watching different camera feeds from all over the Capitol. They've got all their radios with them. And she just described as the scene just deteriorated and they saw rioters running through the building and started to hear officers screaming for help on their radios. And they just realized that there was only so much they could do, that they really felt unprepared. And she broke down crying describing it. So it was fairly emotional for some of them.
Talk about how federal prosecutors built their case against him. You know, what kinds of evidence they used besides direct testimony?
You know, it was really a lot of evidence, I have to say. They really built the case as if someone, you know, in this case, the jurors, didn't know anything about the riot. I think that they all did. But they really explained how it occurred, what happened. They showed the video footage of people attacking. They had witnesses talk from the Senate floor explaining how they had to abandon the session, all to back up all of the various charges for obstruction of Congress and being armed on Capitol grounds and things like this. They showed photographs from Mr. Ruffett's house when they raided it, showing the gun sitting on his nightstand, and then comparing it to pictures taken during the riot where they say he had the same gun on his hip. So cell phone footage from other rioters, Mr. Ruffett's own helmet-mounted camera, his Zoom calls with other militia leaders, things like that. So they put it all out there.
And the defense didn't call any witnesses at all. What was the defense?
Of course, defendants aren't required to put on a case, and the judge, you know, instructed the jury that that shouldn't be interpreted as any sort of admission of guilt or anything like that. But based on the cross-examination of the witnesses, the defense was basically that Mr. Ruffett didn't hurt anyone, didn't damage any property, didn't steal anything, and didn't interfere with any attempts by law enforcement to arrest anyone, and also that he didn't enter the Capitol. Of course, he isn't accused of any of those things. So it was a fairly limited defense. He was stopped by pepper spray before he could go in the Capitol that day. But by then, as the prosecution alleged, he had already encouraged and led everyone else up the stairs. So the defense was really focused on saying that Ruffett hadn't done things that he wasn't accused of. There was some attempt to illustrate that there wasn't enough evidence that he was armed, but the jury clearly did not buy that. There was actually an audio recording of Mr. Ruffett in the mob that day bragging that he had a gun with him. So it really didn't work out with the jury.
The jury didn't take very long to come back with guilty on all charges. Was this trial a test for prosecutors in some ways?
I would say so. I think that especially the obstruction of Congress charge, there's been some, I wouldn't say controversy, but some dispute over whether or not Congress was technically in session at the moment that the Capitol was breached, and whether or not, you know, the counting of the certification of the votes qualifies as the kind of legal proceeding that can be obstructed, sort of technical arguments around that. And clearly the judge had denied a motion to dismiss that charge earlier. And of course it went to trial, and the jury agreed based on the evidence that Congress was in session, that what was happening was an official proceeding of the government, and that it was obstructed by the action. So I did speak with a former federal prosecutor who said that that was an important test to see if a jury would agree that Congress had been obstructed, since that is a charge that we'll see in so many of these cases.
Yeah, prosecutors trying to elevate some of the cases beyond misdemeanor and trespassing. Another judge dismissed that charge against a January 6th rioter this week, saying the law was meant to apply more specifically to destroying documents or records in connection with a proceeding. So we may actually see that question go up to the D.C. Circuit.
Yeah, I think that we probably will. And, you know, the defense lawyer, after the jury verdict was handed down and the jury was dismissed, the defense lawyer did renew his request to have the case thrown out, which is not uncommon after a trial, but he specifically cited that ruling, which had come in another case in D.C. just the prior day, I believe. And the judge had already had her decision prepared on that and said that regardless of that earlier decision, she's standing by her finding that Congress was in session and was obstructed. She said, well, basically what you just said, we'll have to wait and see. It's a question that might be decided by the D.C. Circuit. But she seems to think that words in the statutes were being defined too narrowly in that decision the day before, and that she's standing by her more broad interpretation.
So will this be a bellwether for the trials to come in perhaps the way the prosecution laid out the case?
You know, it's possible. It's hard to predict. But I think one thing that the judge at some point during the trial when the jury wasn't around sort of not admonished but said to the prosecution, you know, you're really doing too much here, almost like showing too much evidence or showing the same evidence too many times, getting too many witnesses to say the same things. So in a way, she was kind of like, look, you've made your case, move on. And just from having watched it, it was a six-day trial. They really did put on so much evidence to prove things that maybe in our minds we feel like, yeah, we already know this right happened. We know this happened. We know this happened. But I think they really wanted to just sew everything up from every angle and just make it sort of impossible to work around the charges. You know, they really have to get around that doubt. So we'll see.
Well, I guess that shows how much the first trial means to sort of set a standard. And also, I think this means that a lot of defendants whose trials are coming up are going to end up pleading.
You know, that would definitely make sense. That's what some have been speculating here, that once they saw how effective the prosecution was at presenting the government's case and how quickly the jury accepted the evidence to back the charges, that do they really want to take that chance and go to trial if they can get some lesser time? And we have seen that some defendants who have pleaded guilty are getting some seemingly short sentences. I mean, just a day or two ago, one defendant, a current FAA employee who's been suspended and he participated in the riot, pleaded guilty to illegal parading in the Capitol. He took a photo in front of Nancy Pelosi's office. He was one of the first people in the building. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to no time behind bars and 3 years of probation. And the government actually had requested only 2 weeks behind bars. So he ended up getting none. So clearly, you know, say what you will about whether that was too lenient or not. There is clearly, as many defense lawyers know, a benefit to pleading out at some point.
It's interesting that outside the courthouse after the verdict, Reffitt's wife told other defendants not to take a plea deal.
Don't take a plea. Do not take a plea. They want us to take a plea. The reason that we have all guilty verdicts is they are making a point out of Guy, and that is to intimidate the other members of the 1-6ers.
Ms. Reffitt.
And we will all fight together.
We'll see what happens there. So what is he facing when he's sentenced on June 8th? I know that Jacob Chansley, the QAnon shaman, as he's known, was sentenced to more than 3 years in prison on, I think, the obstruction charge.
Yeah, well, as you know, a lot of these maximum sentences, you know, they never end up being the amount that is handed down. And when there are multiple counts, they're not always placed on top of each other. They're sort of put together. So I think the maximum sentence for the obstruction charge alone is 20 years. I think you could add them all up and say, you know, maybe it's like 60 years or something, but I don't think it would be anything like that. So we'll see. This judge has set sentencing for June 8th. So we'll see. That'll be another important test to see what judges give these defendants if they're convicted at trial.
Right, because usually there's an extra sort of added on if you make the government prove their case at trial instead of pleading out like Chansley did. So the trials that are happening later this year, the most serious charges against the insurrectionists involve two group trials?
That's right. They're mostly from this group called the Oath Keepers. For the record, Mr. Reffitt was with a militia group called the Three Percenters. But these trials coming up later are mostly Oath Keepers here. There's one in April for some of these militia members who are charged with conspiracy. So that's going to be a real interesting case to see whether these conspiracy charges can stick at trial the same way we saw in this trial just now, whether or not an obstruction of Congress charge can stick. This will show if a much more serious conspiracy charge works. Then in July, we'll see another group of the Oath Keepers who have been charged with the most serious charge from the riot, which is sedition. So I think a lot of people will be watching that to see how far the government can take this attempt to essentially overthrow Congress and force Congress to allow Trump to essentially have another term in office. So whether or not that's sedition still remains to be seen.
And the former chairman of the Proud Boys was arrested. Was that a big arrest?
You know, he was arrested yesterday in Miami, and he's been added to an earlier case against some other Proud Boys, and that's another conspiracy case. And I believe that one goes to trial in May, or at least it's scheduled to at this point. It's unclear if adding Henry Tario is his name, whether that may slow things down. But I would say it's not a surprise, only because, you know, he was the leader of the group, and the group was clearly deeply involved in the planning of that march on the Capitol. You might remember during the presidential debate, Trump was asked to condemn white supremacy and militia groups and groups like the Proud Boys, and he said to the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by. Of course, Trump was pretty widely criticized for that. So the fact that the leader of the Proud Boys has been added to this isn't too surprising to me. I spoke with his lawyer yesterday. He didn't want to comment, but he was wondering whether or not the case would go to trial as planned in May.
Thanks, Eric. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Eric Larson.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
As Russia's invasion of Ukraine heads toward the two-week mark, the stakes are escalating. Russian President Vladimir Putin said again on Sunday the war will continue until Ukraine accepts his demands and halts resistance. Are we in danger of a new Cold War? Joining me is Michael Doyle, a professor at Columbia Law School and Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. Start by telling us about the Cold War and when it ended.
Well, whenever we say the word Cold War, everyone in my generation, the ones before and the one after, of course, thinks about the Cold War, which is the conflict and the contest between the Soviet Union and the United States, the Soviet Union supported by the Warsaw Pact, the U.S. by NATO. It starts up in 1947 and ends roughly with Gorbachev somewhere about 1990. So that's the Cold War. And it's a contest between two superpowers, the U.S., the USSR, divided by two polar opposite ideologies of communism and capitalism, also different political systems of dictatorship and democracy. That's sort of the Cold War. But what I think we should realize is that there are many other conflicts in international history that are special, even if they're not identical. And what makes them special is that they're contests that are not just over a different interest at stake, you know, who controls that province or this province, or who can get the most out of a trade deal and become wealthier. There are conflicts about legitimacy, wherein one partner or one state regards the other as in some form or another illegitimate. That is, that it holds territory that it should not, or that its political system is violative of the principles of the rival. So I think we need to expand the meaning of Cold War to take into account those conflicts over legitimacy. And there are a number of them, and the danger is that we may be entering a new one today in which the U.S. and its liberal, capitalist, democratic allies face off against China and Russia as nationalist autocracies that are also corporatist in their economic orientation. And there's a danger of that that's emerging today.
What would you say the situation between the U.S. and Russia has been for the last, let's say, two decades?
I would go back sort of to three decades. That is, the Cold War ended in 1990. And then there was 10 years, roughly, when Russia was, unfortunately, in a bit of crisis under President Yeltsin, economically and politically, but nonetheless was verging in a direction of shared universal values, as Gorbachev had announced, and movements toward elections and democracy and more of a free market. And that era was one of very considerable cooperation, though not equality, in the 1990s. Starting around the period of 20 years ago, we began to see some deterioration. Russia itself experienced failures in democracy, very problematic movements moving towards a party that was more hegemonic and less tolerant of dissent. At the same time as we saw the emergence of Mr. Putin, a strong man who built a coterie of oligarchs and party officials around himself, determined to reverse the losses that the Soviet Empire had experienced with its collapse in 1990. And so starting then, and then peaking about 2012, the full Putin regime was put in place, a regime in which the state controls media, controls overall corporate activity, and is able to extract rents for it, for its cronies, and manipulates the elections that do occur, such as there's no real accountability, and adopts a quite aggressive foreign military policy in places like Georgia, Syria, and then, of course, most recently in Ukraine.
Do you have a theory about why Putin now decided to invade Ukraine and start this war?
I think it was a opportunity. He saw the West, that is the NATO allies, being both weak and quite divided, increasing dependence upon Russian gas that he thought would deter any united front. He just came off a very successful military campaign in which he propped up Assad in Syria and routed those who were trying to overthrow Assad. So there's a great deal of confidence on the military side, a sense of vulnerability looking into Western Europe, which appeared divided to him. And he was also, I think, concerned that Mr. Zelensky, you know, the then newly elected president, had the capacities for mobilizing Ukraine in a way that made him very far from the kind of clients that he had previously experienced in Kiev. And so we saw Ukraine slipping away He saw the West disunited, and he had just come off a very successful military campaign that made him quite confident in the capabilities of his army. So it looked like an opportunity to him.
Are we entering another phase of a Cold War, or
might it even be worse because he's threatening to use Russia's nuclear capabilities?
My own view is that for the past 10 years, we've been inching towards a Cold War. In suspicions, cyber war, industrial warfare with both Russia and China that have been boiling under the surface for quite a long time. We had a little proxy war in Syria, which, so to speak, the West lost, partly because we had no idea which side we were fighting for, frankly. We certainly weren't fighting for ISIS, which was the major opponent of Assad. So we're in that kind of a different world where we've been edging towards a Cold War. I suspect that this will solidify it in very significant ways, in the same way that the coup in Czechoslovakia in 1948 and the war in Korea solidified the first Cold War. This will solidify not an iron curtain, but a very significant disarticulation, splitting up of the world along ideological lines between autocracy and democracy, as President Biden said. Now, there will be strong pushback against that. The Chinese don't want to enter that kind of a split world. They want to be on both sides. They want the economy of the West and the polity, the politics of Putin. And they've tried to play that middle course. It'll be very difficult now, but they don't want a full-blown Cold War. And the Europeans, of course, would have immense economic cost if there's something like an iron curtain that goes down between Western Europe and Russia.
The United Nations estimates that more than 1.5 million people have fled Ukraine since Russia began bombing. Some countries, Poland, Romania, I think Slovakia and elsewhere, are taking them in.
Well, what's happening is that these deeply unfortunate people are fleeing for their lives to the border. And as you say, it's quite striking, the welcome that they're receiving in the countries you just mentioned, Poland and including Hungary to a certain extent, and certainly Romania and others have stepped forward to welcome the refugees. That's exactly the right thing to do, and they should all deserve commendation for that. Over time, unless we expect, some kind of a quick magical peace and everything gets returned to normal right away, or normal, that is, the independence of Ukraine and peace, which I think is very unlikely, they're going to be in a protracted situation of having to live outside their home country at the expense of, so far, generous Poles and others. And I think it's going to be very important that at least the financial burdens of supporting these refugees, 1.5 million now, who knows how many more are coming, should be shared. It should be shared in Europe. It should be shared globally. The U.S. has announced that we'll be providing $10 billion of support for Ukraine, humanitarian and refugee assistance. That'll probably go through the Congress. And a refugee cost roughly 10,000 euros or so per year. So you multiply the figures out, and one is talking about a considerable number of billions of dollars that will need to be invested to support them in their asylum in the countries, what is now the West. So this will be a humanitarian crisis that's not going to go away quickly. And it's one that we need to share, at least financially.
So the EU has agreed to grant temporary residence to Ukrainians, access to employment, social welfare, and housing for up to 3 years. Is 3 years enough? And also, why hasn't the UK done that?
It's a good question. As you know, the Brexit anxieties that produced Brexit were predominantly driven by immigration concerns in the UK. And so they're deeply allergic to all of this. I think it speaks well to the EU that they've offered the 3 years. Again, I stressed that the financial burden needs to be shared beyond the EU budget. They can afford it, but there's no reason why they should have to pay for it alone. This is a global emergency. The U.S. and Britain have roles to play. The only thing I would say is that, you know, the typical refugee in the world today is outside his or her country for more than 18 years. And so it's very optimistic to think that in 3 years this will be resolved. It would be wonderful if that's the case, but it would require some extremely statesmanlike peacemaking in the very near future, and I suspect some very considerable further peddling back of ambitions by Mr. Putin and some concessions by Ukraine in order to imagine a three-year window that would allow the refugees to be able to go back to Ukraine. And then, of course, all the cost of rebuilding. Today, in the past week, the level of destruction of the major cities radically escalated and is likely to continue to do so in the next few days.
The U.S. has given temporary protected status to Ukrainians who are here by March 1st. That doesn't seem like very much compared to what other nations are doing. Do you think that the U.S. should be doing more, should be taking in Ukrainians?
Yes, we should. That is, again, there'll be many people in asylum in Western Europe who might prefer to be in the U.S. because of family connections, job opportunities, etc. So we too should step up and play our fair share in supporting these refugees. And again, we can do it both by resettlement, that is, by issuing visas and permits to bring refugees here to the U.S., as we did, you know, way back in 1956 with Hungarians who were quickly moved from Western Europe to the United States. And we can provide financial support to assist the Europeans in the, you know, the temporary integration of these persons into Western Europe. The governments, the taxpayers, we should all step up. The people who should really be at the front of the line to pay for these damages that have been inflicted on the Ukrainian people are Mr. Putin and the oligarchs that support him. And measures are afoot in various places to try to seize, not just freeze, the wealth that Putin and his fellow oligarchs have parked in Western banks, in Western Europe, Canada, the United States, and further afield.
Thanks for being on the show. That's Professor Michael Doyle of Columbia Law School and Columbia School of International and Public Affairs.
And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news on our Bloomberg Law podcast. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at www.bloomberg.com/podcast/law. And remember to tune into the Bloomberg Law Show every weeknight at 10 p.m. Wall Street time. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.